Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
KFI AM 640, heard everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. This is Live and Unscripted, offering a newsmaker in Southern California a chance to speak their mind. To join the conversation, call 800-520-1534. That's 1-800-520-1KFI. Now, live from the studios of KFI, the sheriff of Los Angeles County, Alex Villanueva.
Good evening, everyone. This is Sheriff Alex Villanueva. Welcome, everyone. And back here after a hiatus of about a month or so, and we're going to be here on every Sunday from 8 to 10 p.m., and we're going to be discussing just about everything that is important to Angelenos, anything that has to do with public safety. No topic is too small. No question is too challenging. If we don't know the answer, we're going to find it out and we'll get it back to you. So definitely encourage everyone to dial in and call if you have a question, 1-800-521-1KFI. And today we're going to be talking about homicides because I know that is foremost on the mind of everyone with all the recent tragedy we've been seeing in the news. The tragic murder of the 70-year-old nurse, and that was Sandra Shells at the Union Station. The 24-year-old UCLA grad student, that was Brianna Cuffer at that furniture store in Fairfax. Then we had the tragic murder of the 16-year-old Tiana Theus, and her body was dumped off the Washington exit, the 110 freeway in downtown LA. And these numbers keep piling up. And then you had Jackie Avant killed in her home. And there's a lot of things that are going wrong. What are we doing that can make a difference, and how you can empower yourself to not become a statistic? So there's a lot of things we're going to talk about. And this goes to the fabric of a concern that goes across the nation, this rising homicide rate, which is really something astonishing. In LA County alone, we've registered a 94% increase in homicides over the last 2 years, comparing 2019 to 2021. That's 94%. And the astonishing thing about it, though, is I finally have the media now reporting on it and the significance of it, but I still have yet to have the Board of Supervisors acknowledge this in any public forum or as part of their agenda. And they fill their Tuesday meetings all day long with a lot of virtue signaling agenda items, but they never talk about a 94% increase in homicides. Under normal circumstances in any city, anywhere across the nation, that would be an all-hands-on-deck moment. What are we doing wrong? Is there things that we can do and right, things that are within our control? Because you got to remember that homicide, like any type of violent crime, there's a lot of factors that contribute towards it. And we can talk about suspects. We can talk about opportunities. We can talk about victims, how they intersect in tragic moments, of course, and things that are outside of our control. And then we'll talk a bit with the things that are within our control. So there's a lot going on here. We can also talk about the impact of bad legislation. And, typically when someone is incarcerated, say convicted, goes to state prison, they're incapacitated from being able to harm other people. There's an element of deterrence. There's general deterrence because someone else sees what happens to someone who goes to prison and say, well, I don't want to do that. So that's general deterrence. Then you have self-deterrence. The person eventually gets out, depending on what the crime was. They say, well, I did this and I got into prison for this, so maybe I won't do it the next time. And there's always the retribution, which is just a straight punishment. There's a rehabilitation element is too. With our whole goal should be someone goes to jail, goes to prison for whatever the reason may be. At some point, they're going to get out. And should they get out? And I believe they should get out in better shape than they went into jail. But what is being offered in our jail system, for example, in LA County, is we have a scarcity of rehabilitative services available in the county jail. They were not designed for long-term stay. But the Sacramento and the governor, in their infinite wisdom, decided with Assembly Bill 109 or AB 109 that they called it prison realignment. So they kicked the can down the road. Then they pushed a lot of the prisoners that were in the state prisons onto the county jails. And the county jails were not built for these long-term stays. So now they're in our custody, yet we do not have all those rehabilitative services. The funding is not there, and we're being starved of the funds. We're being starved of the program. The facilities are not built for it. You know, you think of a prison yard in all those movies and on wide open facilities, vocational shops and things like that. We really don't have that in the county jail to the degree we should now that we have people staying for a long time in our custody. So that is a big concern of ours. And a lot of these things contribute because eventually people get out of jail. And when they get out, what do they do with their time? They come out, they end up being homeless. They return to the scene of the places where they were committing crime before, and their past associations, you know, if they're hanging out with gang members, they're a member of a gang, for example, they return to that gang lifestyle. So obviously that means that odds are they're going to wind up back in custody down the road. So how can we break this cycle? And there's a lot of issues there that we need to talk about, and we'll look forward to some good questions on this issue. But I can tell you this, just from having been sheriff now for 3 years, just a little over 3 years, some things have changed. The pandemic, we cannot ever underestimate the impact of the pandemic because it has changed so many routines in everyone's lives. A lot of things that we took for granted before are no longer there. A lot of fact that businesses closed forever, a lot of business opportunities lost, jobs that were lost, careers that were lost, and they were never recovered. That is a lot of tension, a lot of mental anguish out there, increased rates of mental illnesses. We're seeing it on calls for service on the patrol side of the house. And people are, a lot of the normal interactions with the community have been severed because of the pandemic. People are keeping more distance. So there's a lot more isolation out there. A lot of things are devolving over time that people are not paying attention to it reaches critical stage. And that's a problem. And also is a problem, for example, that there's such a high level of mental illness out there in the community because we don't have our mental health institutions. So people are doing strange things in public that normally would have warranted a 911 call, for example. They don't. They progress and they're doing things that doesn't come to the attention of law enforcement until it becomes too late. Then it's a critical case. And that tragic LAPD officer-involved shooting, the Burlington Coat Factory, is a prime example of that. So, there's a lot of things that we need to be working on, and I'm excited to have our guest here today, which is going to be Captain Joe Mendoza from our Sheriff's Homicide Bureau. He's in charge of one of the most decorated homicide units in the nation with experienced people. So we're going to have a good talk with him about how he got to where he's at and what he does with the homicide unit and the challenges that they're facing in this environment. Because remember, we're coming off 2 years in a row of defunding of law enforcement. And when you defund and you freeze hiring, for example, what you're doing is you're drying out the chain of people going from being in the academy to going to custody, going to patrol, to go to specialized units. And they start going over towards the highly specialized units. That whole chain gets interrupted to this point that today our detective division has 25% vacancies. 25%. That's over 200 investigators that should be working, should be solving crime, should be arresting bad guys. And they're not doing that because of the hiring freeze of the county has imposed. So this is something that we need to really think on. So we're going to move on to then. We'll on our next segment, we're going to be talking with Captain Joe Mendoza. But uh, welcome back, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. And remember, if you have a question, 1-800-521-KFI. Now, let's introduce with a big round of applause, Mr. Jose Mendoza, our captain of our homicide bureau. Please tell us about yourself.
Good evening. Thank you, Sheriff. I'd like to start just to kind of talking about how I got to where I am today. Originally, I'm kind of the American dream. What people talk about is English is my second language. I was born here in East L.A. My mom and dad moved to Mexico. I came back in the second grade, and then I had to learn English. I was in that ESL class, and I think that's where I first got my protective skills. Some of my classmates would get picked on, and I always wanted to protect them, and I knew I could protect myself. So that's where it kind of started. And I go, one day I want to be a police officer. And I used to see LA Unified School District, the cops that were on campus. And I used to look at them and go, oh, I want to do that one day. So as time went on, I learned English. I went to LA Unified School District school. I grew up in the east side of LA City in a little area known as El Sereno, where I then was in contact with a baseball coach that was a deputy sheriff, and he would volunteer to coach the young kids at the park. And so that coach, Sean, motivated me to become a deputy sheriff.
Wow, that's pretty cool. And I'm going to take a wild guess that your parents didn't tell you to be scared of the police, right?
They didn't. My mom and dad really, I mean, when you come from Mexico where you can't trust the police, they were just in awe of the police and always have respected them and always taught me to respect them and to, you know, just telling me that they're good people and they're here to help.
Well, that's pretty cool. Well, now that you're in the homicide unit, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, but I want to take a call here because this is something important. We got Frank on line 6. He has an important question about innocent people being in prison. Go ahead, Frank.
Yes, hi. Sheriff, you know, well, I highly respect you. I'm sure glad you're sheriff. And after you help clean up L.A., reverse the depravity here, I hope you run for governor. Now, after that, I'm just getting right to the point. I have no problem with individuals committing depraved, senseless murders like the killings of these four young people in Englewood, especially two beautiful young girls in the black community, and also the hero of L.A., LAPD officer Fernando Royals, and, of course, Steve Owens of the Sheriff's Department and the two officers out in Palm Springs, one had a four-month-old baby. No problem with direct evidence convicting these individuals, putting them away for life, or even giving them the death penalty. I'm fine with that. But the California's justice system is just so dysfunctional, messed up. And we do have innocent people in prison. Most of them are women. Most of them have life without possibility of parole, and they didn't do anything. And just want to know, is it possible if you in the sheriff's department or anybody in law enforcement could help us try to get these people out? Because the progressives seem so scared and terrified in doing the right thing. But they're always there, and we have a lot of ignorant people in the black community.
All right, well, Frank,
vote for them.
All right, Frank, let's take that part by part. Let's start with Captain Mendoza. Why don't you take the first part of that?
Well, the first part is, you know, I have an unsolved unit that also dubs as a review unit. So anytime we have cases that come forward that somebody brings to our attention, we do review them. We've actually worked on one in the last 6 months with some of the DA investigators, and we were able help somebody get out of prison that we believe was wrongfully convicted. And now we're working on arresting the suspect that actually committed the crime.
I believe when I first took office in 2018, we had homicide investigators. They retired. We hired them back as what they call 120-dayers, working part-time. They actually work with DA Jackie Lacey, and they had, I believe, two cases in particular where the individual was already convicted in prison, and they had the conviction reversed. They got him out of prison, and they found the suspects and were able to actually turn the tables and got the suspect arrested. So when we have information that a case needs to be corrected, it will be, and we will do everything in our power, because there's nothing worse than having someone who is innocent in jail for someone else's crime. Then, you know, that is that cannot be tolerated. Can it happen by human error without any willful intent? It's a possibility. However, now to get that proof from the district attorneys beyond reasonable doubt, those cases that could be marginal cases, circumstantial evidence now, for example, with the DNA, with a lot of high quality video, a lot of things, a fingerprint, all these different analysis now. So it's really starting to narrow down, and the potential for mistakes in the past was far greater than the potential for mistakes now are, because there's been so many advances in the sciences that is really helping us clear cases and also in solving these cold cases. And in fact, we had one, a retired Sergeant Joe Purcell, he solved a 26-year-old cold case through DNA. And this is remarkable, and it does work. The system does correct itself. So we just have to make sure we're always on top of it. So anyway, what we're going to talk about here. Anyway, I'm Sheriff Alex Villanueva. This is KFI AM 640. So when we come back, we're going to talk about what the previous caller said, Officer Fernando Arroyos and his tragic death.
KFI AM 640, heard everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. To speak with the sheriff, call 800-520-1534. That's 1-800-520-1KFI. Now, once again, L.A. County Sheriff Alex Villanueva.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. And let's, off the top here, let's go over to Captain Mendoza and tell us about this tragic murder of Officer Fernando Arroyos. Where are we at today?
Well, today we have four of the suspects in federal custody as of today. And we're looking forward to a grand jury that's going to convene. I believe it's January 22nd. So that's where we're at with that. But in regards to that awful murder on that Monday night, I just want to give credit to those investigators that were out there. I had laid down to go to sleep. It was right around 10 p.m. I'd been in bed for about 2 minutes, and the phone rang, and it's what you dread, talking about an officer that had been killed, and he was off duty. When we all met at the scene, it was quite a sight. Although a very sad occasion, you can see that there was about 75 LAPD officers just right outside of the crime scene tape, and all of their robbery homicide had rolled, and our units were there. Major Crimes Unit had set up a team of detectives and also our Operation Safe Street Bureau, and they were all ready to go, waiting for direction from the handling detectives. Those detectives worked tirelessly, like maybe about 30 hours, until they had all four suspects in custody. And that was just extreme teamwork from everyone. Every single investigator out there gave his all, and I just got to give credit to them.
Well, that's definitely my hats off to all of those involved. And it was a good example. And our homicide unit, their robbery homicide, the FBI, the assistant U.S. attorney. And definitely it was an example of people coming together. We got a call there on line one, Moses. Let's hear from you.
Yes, Sheriff and Captain Mendoza, I commend you both for getting the feds involved in this case with Officer Fernando Arroyos. Is there any hope in getting the feds involved in the Inglewood shooting?
Well, Moses, this is Captain Mendoza. Inglewood is they conduct their own murder investigations. However, I will tell you, because some of the folks reached out to me, hey, there's another murder here. Can we also take it federally? Well, I will tell you, there's over 10 murders that we are currently investigating in our unit, and that we are also expecting for these federal task force to take over for prosecution.
Yeah, that, and then got to realize that we can use the feds when it's appropriate. In the case of Fernando Rose, it was very appropriate. And then this goes back to our concerns we have with the current district attorney, George Gascon, and his blanket policies of not seeking the death penalty, not seeking gang enhancements, gun enhancements, and so many things that are special circumstances that could give a possible either a death penalty sentence or a life without sentence. He's bringing them all down to where you might actually just get a 20-year sentence. In fact, one of them that he's not pursuing, which is very bizarre, is multiple victims. So we could have five people in one room be killed by one person, and the DA will consider it to be one murder. And that just is mind-boggling. And it goes beyond that, though, because there's other things, and we'll talk about it in another segment here, but he's also unraveling cases that have already been dispositioned. The individual has been tried, convicted properly in a court of a competent jurisdiction. The person is in state prison, either on death row. And the district attorney has given word that every single one of these convicted suspects can appeal their sentence, and the DA is going to literally roll over and not challenge it. So you're going to have a wholesale changing of conviction. So this is re-victimizing victims who already suffered through the tragic loss of their loved one. They suffered through the anguish of the trial itself, how gut-wrenching that experience might be. They think the person was properly convicted and sentenced, and that's it. And now they're going to undo that as well for whatever purpose he's trying to sell and claim that somehow that's going to drive down recidivism rates, makes us all safer. I think that's absolute nonsense. And it, I don't know where he comes up with that idea, but that is really not going to work for us. It's not going to work for public safety. And this is part of his entire idea of having offender-centric policies instead of victim-centric policies. And he talks constantly about harm reduction. In fact, you'll hear some of the members of the Board of Supervisors talk about harm reduction, but never is it victims that they're concerned about reducing the harm for victims. They want to reduce the harm for offenders, and they believe that incarcerating offenders somehow harms the offender. It was the absolute dismissal of the welfare of victims of violent crime or the families of survivors. And that is just, it's a sad state of affairs. But of course, the people that always propose these type of policies are never the ones that are going to be suffering the consequences of them, because it's not their loved one who was murdered. It's not the killer of their loved one that's in prison who's going to get a light sentence or possibly be back out on the streets. And that's just astonishing right there. And I look no further than the case of that 10-year-old girl who was sexually assaulted in a Denny's restaurant back in Palmdale. And the suspect was, I think, 2 weeks shy of his 18th birthday. And when the crime came, connecting the suspect to the crime happened when he was already an adult. And by the time it came before the courts to be adjudicated, the district attorney says he's not going to charge him as an adult. He's going to charge him as a juvenile. However, in juvenile court, the supervision or the jurisdiction over the suspect ends at the age of 25. This person, when he committed the crime, was known as James Tubbs. He has since declared himself to be transgender, and now he's identifying himself as she. So she now is the ripe old age of 26 and could potentially walk away with no consequences for having sexually assaulted a 10-year-old girl. And somehow our district attorney is going to claim that that makes us safer. And that's just bizarre. So I don't know. That does not sit well with me, does not sit well to anybody that I've come across up in Palmdale. And so definitely have a lot of concerns for that. Captain Mendoza, would you care to add to that?
Yeah, so, well, we've seen that. There was a case in 2015 out of the North County area with Luis Amela. It was a 17-year-old suspect, and all the DA had to do, because of Prop 57 that kicked in 2016, all he had to do is ask the judge to have a hearing to see the fitness of this person that had already been in prison and was doing a life sentence. The DA's office refused to have that hearing, and that person walked.
Wow. That's incredible. So anyway, I'm Sheriff Alex Villanueva, and this is KFI AM 640. Welcome back, everyone. And let's talk about something that happens very rarely, but is definitely a life-altering event. And these are deputy-involved shootings or officer-involved shootings. And we, I know there's a lot of misinformation out there in the media. A lot of activists like to portray that this is a very common occurrence and that there's people being felled left and right by cops, and that somehow cops are an existential threat to young black men. But the actual hard numbers do not show that at all. They're actually quite the opposite. In fact, deputy-involved shootings are extremely rare. And I think for the last year, 2021, any type of use of force involved deadly force came out to be 1/1000th of 1%. And that's out of more than 2 million contacts with the community. So those odds are actually less than being struck by lightning. So let's keep that in mind. But there's a there's an issue about, you know, when a deputy-involved shooting happens, who does the investigation? How do we hold people accountable? And for those that may not believe this yet, we actually do hold our employees accountable to, obviously, the Constitution, to the rule of law, penal code, all that, and also to the policies of the department that are designed to keep people safe and minimize potential for deadly force. And de-escalation is part of that process. There is an expectation for me that every employee is always going to seek a way to end any conflict in the most peaceful manner possible and keep everyone safe. But sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes things happen that the individual involved is going to make decisions that's going to be life-threatening for people. That's going to cause a deputy to possibly pull the trigger. And when it does happen, a bunch of things happen all at once. And let's hear from Captain Mendoza, basically the steps that are taken when there's a deputy-involved shooting.
Okay, our main goal when we respond to a deputy-involved shooting is to conduct a fair and impartial investigation. And because of that is why we take so many steps to protect that investigation. Originally, when we get notified that it occurred within LA County and it happened in one of our patrol areas, we respond with at least four investigators, and we go out to the scene with a team lieutenant, and I, as a captain, also respond. We call the Internal Affairs Bureau, who also responds to the scene. Our civil litigation unit also responds to the scene, and along with the OIG, the Office of Inspector General's representatives. At the time, we get briefed on the incident. We do a walkthrough of the scene, and then we let the investigators go about their work, which is to document the scene with photographs. We call in the crime lab. They process all the evidence. We also call our fraud and cyber crimes unit, who can look for cameras. And we call in our body-worn camera unit, who then can review all of our cameras and all the footage that was taken during that deputy-involved shooting. And lastly, the DA's office also goes there, and we brief on the incident.
Yeah, definitely. We don't want to downplay the role the Justice System Integrity Division is going to play in these cases. So you have three, four, five of different entities all doing this investigation. And as large an organization as the Sheriff's Department is, also bear in mind that we are that third-party investigator for the majority of the cities in Los Angeles County when their police departments are involved in officer-involved shootings. So there's only a handful, I think, like LAPD, I think Santa Monica PD, Long Beach PD, Pasadena,
Burbank, Glendale.
Yeah, that's about six of them, and that's it. So the other 40 of them, roughly, they're going to be investigated by our department. And it's a very robust process, so we make sure all the information is properly assessed. It's vetted by multiple sources. And if there's a concern that I may have as sheriff regarding a case and the decision were made, we have referred cases to the Attorney General for the state of California. We have also invited in the FBI to monitor our cases as well. And one example, for example, with the Attorney General was the case of Andres Guardado that happened in 2020. That is a case where we actually invited the Attorney General to monitor the case with us. And one thing we've found out during these cases, though, is that Justice System Integrity Division is supposed to return a result on their decision whether or not the shooting was within legal parameters. It was a lawful homicide. And that is way too slow right now. We have cases that are 5-6 years old. We have a bevy of cases that are 3 to 4 years old. And, you know, the old saying is just as delayed is just as denied. And the problem is when the DA takes so long to return a case after they've been presented with everything, it puts everyone's life on hold. It puts the family of the person who died as a result of the deputy-involved shooting on hold. It puts the deputies involved, the officer involved, their life's on hold as well, where everyone's waiting for an outcome. And we don't want to hurry a decision, but at the same time, you know, beyond 90 days, I find it hard to believe it takes that long to render a decision, because our homicide bureau is going to put together a massive documentation, turn it over, and they average about 6 to 8 months to complete a case and turn it over. So why would it take the district attorney 4 years to turn a decision back? So that is something, a big concern. But right now, let's take a call. Let's go to Bill on line two. We have you there?
Yes, hello. Good evening.
Good evening.
I wanted to, first of all, commend your department for the bravery of your officers and all the wonderful work that you do for our county. But my question this evening was involving the Constitution and how that interplays between the controls of our mayor, our city council, and our county supervisor's office. I don't feel that they're behaving in a constitutional way myself, and I represent a large majority of people in that regard, and you're one of the few people that's sworn in to protect the entire county, and I'm just wondering, how do we as a city, a county, address our government when we feel that they're not behaving in a just way? But, you know, we need help now, not 5 years from now or whatever, when they get reelected.
Well, that's a good question, Bill. I'll tell you this. One of the first things you can do, and everyone needs to do, is you have to be an informed voter. Way too many politicians are just dirty. They're crooks, and they get attracted to elected office, and they get palms greased with campaign contributions, and all they do is serve the needs of the people that put them in office, and the community is way down on the list of priorities for them. Their number one goal is to get reelected. So you get a lot of the nonsense that you're seeing right now. I mean, how many mayors and councilmen are in the back pockets of developers and supervisors? That's as old as they start allowing campaign contributions to be a legalized form of bribery. So one thing we can do is you got to be informed voter. You got to hold the elected officials accountable. And I'll give you a prime example of this. And just on the issue of homelessness. If your mayor, your supervisor, your city council says you can't do anything about homelessness and they keep throwing money at the homeless industrial complex, hold them accountable to that. Don't vote them back into office. Anybody who's proposing to become one of these elected officials, ask them, what is your plan? What is your plan to reduce violent crime and homicides? Are you going to adhere to the defunding of law enforcement? If you're sticking to that, well, that's someone I definitely take a hard pass on. So we got to definitely hold our people accountable for that. So that is my take on that. But anyway, I'm Sheriff Alex Villanueva, and this is KFI AM 640. So when we come back, we're going to ask Captain Mendoza about certain cases that stick out.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.